Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello. It's June 13th, 2018, folks. My wonderful, wonderful listeners. You have no idea how important you are to me. And one reason is I haven't really let you know. I have been doing this show for 8 years. For 8 years, it's a part of my week that really, really matters to me. And for many years, I've begun it with this opening about the great listeners and how sometimes I mention how much I enjoy meeting you. And it never dawned on me how much more I can do. See, there's a change going on in me now, which is I'm getting more and more into communicating with this world and talking with this world and sharing with this world. I've spent so much time up to now establishing my scientific credentials, writing scientific books. You know, I've written more than 20 books, all of them heavily annotated with science. I've been doing scientific articles. I've been writing scientific blogs, and all that is good and wonderful. But meanwhile, I need to be reaching out more to you. And the real irony is that this my listeners have meant so much to me, and yet I haven't given you any opportunities to communicate with me. And that's just been because, I don't know, maybe nervousness about changing the format. You know, it's one of the more successful shows on this this great network. And, you know, maybe just the comfort of spending an hour talking with people whom I often know and I know will be able to carry a good show. But people want to hear more from me, and I want to hear more from you. So, and I'm going to have a great guest today. I'm not changing that, but the guests are going to fit into this larger format. So, number one, we are taking callers. I don't think I've taken callers in 6 or 7 years. The opportunity's always been there. PRN-FM has that format. I'm going to start taking callers. And the number is 888-874-4888. Let's try to make it relevant to the show. I think that was my initial concern way years ago. Try to make it relevant to the show. But we're going to be taking callers. 888-874-4888. You can get it on also on www.prn.fm. Get the number. And that's going to, you know, you'll be able to call anytime. The phones are going to be open, and we're gonna you know be screening and doing the things that other shows do. But I want everybody to get through, so I'm hoping we're gonna have really wonderful interchanges, and I look really really forward to that. Now that's just the first part, and by the way, probably toward the second half of the show is when I'll open the lines, but you can call in. In addition to that, you can now communicate directly with me. Not exactly during the show, but I don't have that capacity right now. I'd have to be going to look at the email. But, you know, email me sometime before the show, anytime over the 24-hour period or whatever period of hours you want. And you can ask me a question. You can tell me how you think the show is going. You can You can affect the direction of the show. Now, I won't be emailing back. That would just tie me up more than I'm tied up now, which is a good deal of the problem that I'm trying to get away from. But I will be able to hear you, and I will respond on the air when it seems appropriate, and you definitely can influence the direction of the show. Tell me whether you like the new format. So those are two big things. We are taking callers, and there's an email. Now, what is the email? It's Breggin Live at hotmail.com. BreganLive@hotmail.com. Now, I'm going to, if you're just tuning in and this show sounds familiar, next week I'm going to replay this show because I'm traveling doing a legal case. And it's a good thing, I think, for people to hear this again or to tune into it, have the opportunity to tune into it for the first time. So if you're calling in next Wednesday and not on June 13th, you're going to hear this fresh, but you won't be able to call in because the show has been recorded. Now, I also have new features on the show. I'm going to be doing a breaking news and information. My wife Ginger loves to send me news and information. My assistant Ian is great at that. And so we're going to have breaking news and information. And that's going to have links to the website where you can look up, where you can hear me talk today about psychiatrists and, you know, being burning out. You can hear me talk today. I'm going to about increasing suicides throughout the country. And does that relate to psychiatrists burning out? I think, which is a big, broad and interesting topic. And then you can go to Bregan.com, to my website, Bregan.com, real easy to get to my website. And then you can see under selected highlights up on the left-hand part of the page, you'll see breaking news and information. That means that's where you can go instantly to the sources. And then there'll be other sources where we just put up things that look interesting over the past week or two. So we've got the breaking news information, and then the links to the website. And you can find the links under selected highlights on the site. And then I'm going to do a little feature called BATF, Brief Advice for Today and Forever. I'm giving advice all day long to people. I listen, I care, I get involved, but I give advice. And often it seems real meaningful to them. So I'm going to try to engage in that. I will engage in that. Probably do all of these each time we get together. And don't forget the archives for the radio show. You can always go there. Find them on my website again. And don't forget the frequent alerts. The frequent alerts, which brings me to my guest. Last week, my guest, Michael Cornwall, a wonderful psychologist, PhD psychologist from California, he does seminars at Big Sur. He's just got a great volume of articles coming out in which I'm one of the folks. And when I read Michael's article, I was so impressed with it. It was like one of the best things I'd ever read on relationship and the family and in therapy and comparing them and breaking down the barriers between who can give help to whom. It was such a good article. And it's about his breakdown when he was young, a severe breakdown, and how his grandmother, who had basically done most of the raising, you can correct me if I'm misremembering, how she would touch him on the forehead and stroke him and reassure him as a little child, and how she did that as a young adult when he had his breakdown. And we might talk about that some today. I mean, it's just so moving. And I wanted Michael on today because of that article, but I wanted him on today because he gives me comfort and strength as a human being. We have such similar values, and he has such good, solid way he has built his life. And so I'm glad to have him on for my wonderful listeners, welcoming you to all of this. Let me just see if Michael's there. Michael, are you there?
Yes, Peter.
Hi, good to hear your voice. So let me go, folks, and then I'm going to turn Michael loose on this. I want to talk about the breaking news. And there's two things in the news that I think are connected. No one else in the world probably is connecting them. One is we have a skyrocketing suicide rate in this country, especially for men, but it's for women too. And interestingly enough, even some of the media now are catching on to this and wondering, how can we have a massively increasing suicide rate when everybody, 20, 30% of the population is taking drugs that is supposed to help them with their suicide problems? And I'm literally hearing media here and there actually raise those questions. So On the one hand, we have the rising suicide rate. And on the other, we have an article, and you can get both of these again by going to the website and looking at selected highlights, and just the third one down, you pick out, and that's breaking news and information where you'll get the connections to these articles. And then you have an article coming out in a psychiatric newspaper talking about burnout in psychiatrists. Now, they're not talking about burnout in old folks. That happens too, of course. They're not talking about burnout in overworked 50-year-olds. They're talking about burnout across the board, including their young psychiatrists. So what's the connection between the rising suicide rate and the burnout of young psychiatrists? Well, I suppose it could be that a number of them are having suicides, and that discourages them. But that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about that they just don't have relationship in their lives. That's one of the biggest things. Now, what do they mean by that? They mean they're so busy doing paperwork that they don't have relationships. Well, what about to their patients? No, they don't have relationships to their patients. That's the irony built into that article, that they don't even realize because they don't even think of having relationships. And I don't mean relationships outside the office. I mean genuine caring friendships within the restrictions of a therapy relationship. They don't have that. What they're complaining about is all their colleagues are too busy. So why are they really burning out? Is it because their colleagues are too busy and they have too much paperwork? Well, it's no fun. But I can tell you for certain that the real reason is they don't love, care for, and connect to their patients. And I want Michael Cornwell in a couple of minutes to come on and start maybe with that theme, that they don't connect to their patients. When I get up in the morning, I never think, oh, I have to see patients today. Clients. I prefer to call them clients, but I'm a medical doc and publicly, and, you know, people get confused. They think I'm a counselor or a lawyer or something. So I don't get up in the morning thinking, oh, boy, God, I don't see my patients and my clients. I didn't even think that way when I was younger and seeing 35 hours a week and maybe 50 people, because some of them were couples. And I don't feel it now either. In fact, my wife, Ginger, I was talking to her about the show this morning, and she says, honey, you could be tired in the morning. You could have junk on your mind, usually from the legal cases where I'm representing people and the lawyers aren't doing a good job often, or the, you know, things are coming up from the other side that are just plain ridiculous and mean and so on and so forth. I get up feeling grumpy, or I just have too many legal cases I'm getting up grumpy about. Not all the time. Last few weeks, a few times, so. She says, but once you've seen your first patient, you just bounce around the office. You look happy. Well, why is that? Because human relationship is the key. And I don't think psychiatrists are going to rescue themselves by having better relationships with their colleagues when they don't have relationships with their patients. In fact, again, I was chatting with Ginger about that. She said, you know, when you're a psychiatrist dealing with your patients, you have to at times think to yourself, well, God, I have some of these symptoms. What's going to happen to me? And all they can think of is they'll be drugged too. You know, how can you be happy drugging practically everybody, if not everybody you see? How can you be happy when somebody comes in, gives you the privilege of a lifetime to talk with them in a caring, even loving manner, certainly an empathic manner, about their troubles in life? What a gift from God to us. Previously only probably been priests of the Catholic Church, you know, hundreds of years ago, had this privilege. And we have it. And what do? We take notes. We bury our faces in a typewriter and in a computer. We don't relate warmly. We spend 15 minutes because that's what the insurance will cover it, and we're shaving it to 12 and trying to get five people in an hour. Maybe less minutes even. So work has to be depressing when you're oppressing the other person instead of relating to them. Because the key to life, and now I get to my final feature, such a key to life, And this is BATF, Brief Advice for Today and Forever. The key to life is at least one good, loving relationship. The key to a wide and rich life is a number of good and loving relationships. And if you're like my mother-in-law, I feel like she's my mother, Ginger's mother, Jean, who lives with us now, multiple relationships, good, solid ones through her church, through the community services, through environmental work with the Isaac Walton League, when she was teaching for 20 years through children and other teachers. That's the secret for many people, is multiple good and astonishing relationships. For me, basically, I need a few people and I enjoy my clients. And then I have friends all over the world, including like Michael, such a wonderful person. So keep that in mind. If you are not doing well in your life, it probably has more to do with relationships than anything. And if you're feeling suicidal, and if you're feeling terrible burnout, it's surely got to do with relationships. I know it may feel like it's the economy, and indeed more suicides occur during a heavy economy, bad economy. You may think it's your own personal economic troubles. You may think it's illness. You may think it's cancer. But I'll tell you from all these decades on earth now, that if you have loving relationships, you make it through everything. And the horror of psychiatric drugs is that loving relationships become one way when you get put on psychiatric drugs. They become one way. I don't think I've ever quite put it that way. So you may have a loving wife, and many people who kill themselves now do. You may have loving children and parents, and many people can kill themselves now do. Why? Because they cannot feel the loving relationship and return it on psychiatric drugs. The worst offenders, well, it's all of them. It's the antidepressants. It's the stimulants. It's the benzos. It's the antipsychotics. All of them harm the frontal lobes and make it hard for you to love and be loved. And I believe that overall use of psychiatric drugs along with street drugs is probably a major cause of what's happening in our world today of increasing suicidality in America, the society that consumes more drugs than anywhere on earth. So that's my new beginning. That's my new show. Before I hand it over to Michael, and he and I will be answering questions later on, remember you can call in 888-874-4888, and you can email me. Don't do it during the show. Listen to the show, but you can now email me at breganlive@hotmail.com. Hi, Michael. I'm out of breath. I never talk so much at the beginning of a show, except when I've done them by myself. How are you?
I'm good, Peter. I'm really glad to be here today for your new format, which is wonderful. I'm glad you're opening it up like this. I hope we get some callers. And I just love all that you're saying there. I also was sitting here and just feeling kind of a heartbreak of what you're saying too. There's no doubt in my mind either that the huge increase in suicide rates has absolutely to do with the massive increase in the drug that are dispensed by psychiatry. I mean, you and I were both around when a lot of those, especially the first and second generation, the second generation antipsychotics and, the SSRIs came online, and with all the hype about how it's going to help people. And immediately any of us who were there in the front line seeing the effects of those medications saw the incredible numbing, just like you said, that emotional life that we all need to connect with people, to connect with ourselves, to love ourselves. Yes, it numbs the pain, but at what cost? And I think also I saw when that started happening, the psychiatrist that I'd worked with starting in 1980 in that public mental health system, who 3/4 of their time was designated for them to do psychotherapy. They were doing, like most psychiatrists did back then, psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And 1/4 or 1/2 of their time was doing medication. And then as the new meds and the pharma pushed it all, it came, you know, to where, like you say, they were trying to squeeze in five patients an hour. And oftentimes I'd be in the room with some client that I was trying to help get off medication. And the psychiatrist was basically chained to their computer. They had to turn to their computer through the whole time there, typing in their notes, typing in the assessment, kind of glancing over their shoulder at the poor person who was suffering. So that's kind of embedded, emblazoned or whatever on my mind, how that was. Like you say, the huge missed opportunity to connect with someone who came there, especially in those outpatient clinics. People came there of their own free will, and they came there with hope that they were going to get some caring. And instead, they got that disease model that, you know, kind of instantly saw them through that lens of that they're a disordered, diseased, brain imbalanced person. So, yeah, I have a lot of passion about this too, because you mentioned my own experience, you know, back in the 1960s when I went through some of these extreme states, kind of set the course for my whole life. And that loving care I got from my grandmother, who was in her 80s, to this day, now I'm 72. That article I wrote recently called Merciful Love Can Help Relieve the Emotional Suffering of Extreme States. I realized that my greatest teacher about that was my grandmother, who was this very down-to-earth kind of pioneer woman who just loved me unconditionally. And so to this day, when I'm with clients, people, peers, I try and be in touch with my heart. And those trainings I do at Esalen and all over around getting providers to be in touch, or caregivers to be in touch with our hearts, as you know, you've so wonderfully for decades talked about that. I mean, I was looking at the article you wrote for that journal, Humanistic Psychology, and you talked about cherishing and respecting the person that you're there with, cherishing. You know, that's seen as very wrong by the people who were, you know, trained in that disease model. We're not supposed to cherish that person who's suffering. We're not supposed to open our heart, and we're not supposed to, God forbid, we might be so moved that we would shed a tear in the face of all that suffering, you know? So I'll stop there, but I just think that that huge gulf between what is offered to people is so meager compared with what people need. I just say over and over, Peter, I have people tell me who finally, you know, find their way to me or someone like you, say, how was it that I sat there with this psychiatrist for years, 3 feet away from them, trying to pour my heart out, and I felt like they never saw me and they never heard me? I mean, that is a huge both indictment of the disease model, but also it's a tragic missed opportunity.
It's really amazing, and it's always been that way. When I was a psychiatric resident, especially at Harvard, which was the avant-garde, the new place, within 1 year, literally, it changed from being a psychoanalytically, psychologically oriented place. Of course, I'm not psychoanalytically oriented, but I was learning a lot from my psychoanalytic supervisors. But it changed from that to a drug place overnight. I mean, it wasn't a scientific revolution. It was a money revolution. And literally, I went thinking I was going to be, you know, doing family therapy half the week, you know. I didn't get to do any family therapy, and I got to do a little psychotherapy because I insisted on it. The young psychiatrists on the ward at Harvard were treating patients without any experience. It was their first year in residency. They'd had a normal medical internship back then and a normal medical school. So now they're seeing patients for the first time in their lives. And who are they seeing? They're on a ward. They're not even in a clinic, especially then with the changes. They weren't in a clinic. They were seeing the patients who psychiatrists in Boston were unable to help and made them worse, maybe, and they got worse, and they landed in a mental hospital. And some young kid, many from Harvard or Yale or Princeton, a few women, mostly men, kids who had spent their whole time studying and getting ahead and getting straight A's to get into Harvard's psych program, they had no idea how to talk to the patients, and the patients are completely dissociated from them because they're freaking out. They need somebody who's loving and caring. And I used to, when I was, when they'd be on call at night, they'd sit in their office, you know, and wait to see if there was an emergency on the ward or something. And when I was on call at night, I would go out and I'd sit in the day room with the patients.
Yeah.
And they'd come, people I knew, I didn't know. You know, we'd sit around three or four people, seven people, 10 people. We'd be having great conversations with patients who, quote, weren't participating in group therapy and weren't relating to their doctors because they were sick. And, you know, the other residents got angry at me. They said I was manipulating the patients to like me.
Oh,
now,
God.
Can you imagine that? First, is that a sin? Encouraging? What do you mean manipulating? Suppose you were. Suppose I was encouraging the patients to like me. I wanted them to like me. I very much wanted them to like me. And I very much wanted to like them. That was part of the getting well, was having a decent relationship with people. So, it's really, really, it's so key to life. It's absolutely key to life that we have relationships, the starting point of all helping relationships. And whether you're helping your mother, your father, or yourself, it's about your relationship. But from the beginning, that's a scan. It's the last thing you're taught. You're never taught it in a psychiatric residency. And these young people, they were so aghast, at dealing with patients. One of them had a patient who got aggressive during the night, and he called in the anesthesiologist, and they gave shock treatment. His first-year resident for being aggressive. It's bizarre, but it was it fit the system. I don't know that he was ever criticized for it. We had a couple of suicides on the ward. I already knew from my psychiatric internship, which I had to, there was only one in the country at the time, that I'd already been at upstate New York, the medical center there, that I already knew that you weren't supposed to have completed suicides, when people went home or on visit or went to another hospital for an illness or whatever, suicides, you're in treatment, you shouldn't be getting suicides. But they didn't know the difference. I could tell them, but we never had a suicide from any of our patients at the Upstate Medical Center, where the people were much more humane, more caring, more involved, less interested in competition. Some of them, many had families. Some liked to fish and hunt and do other guy things. Or there were some women, who did whatever they were doing. It wasn't like they were preoccupied with themselves and getting ahead. So, wow. So, Michael, talk to me some more about some of this stuff and where you're going with your work. I mean, after having written this, did you get nice feedback other than from me? When I put you up on my frequent alerts with your wonderful article?
Yes, I did. I posted it on my website and on Facebook and to several groups. And that article was in line with what you were talking about, connecting with people in that way. I felt a little anxiety about it, although I've talked about responding with loving receptivity and done workshops on that for years. This article, I went quite a bit further and really kind of broke down that moment of when that connection happens and both the caregiver opens their heart and the person receives that across that threshold, kind of like a transaction happens when we've all felt that, you know, when we've given love and received love in that compassionate way. I was a little anxious that, you know, I might get some response like you got from your colleagues there, that somehow that was wrong, you know, that God forbid you would want to connect, and, you know, that they interpreted your goodwill to connect with those people as somehow manipulative. I think it's a huge challenge to that disease model that sees, you know, people suffering as a medical pathology. I mean, all those psychiatrists you work with, all the psychiatrists I've worked with for the last 40 years, they're all good people. They get up in the morning. They're going to work to serve. They're wanting to help. But they're burdened by this incredible paradigm that, you know, it's really made psychiatry, in my view, a failed medical specialty. I mean, you can't have a medical specialty like psychiatry that, you know, for these diagnoses of schizophrenia and so-called, you know, bipolar and everything, where you have people dying 25%, 25 years younger than life, you know, than the average life expectancy. I mean, there, no other medical specialty that wasn't, you know, like oncology. I mean, like, you know, ophthalmology or orthopedics, if people, you know, the doctors in those specialties had that kind of death rate, it would be a huge outcry. But it just shows to me how, you know, it's a failed medical specialty, but it's a failed social institution, too. Our whole kind of scientific view of human life and human suffering. So, yeah, the emphasis on that connection, that moment when we feel cared about, you know, when we feel that agape, when we feel that that loving presence, that's really what that's what is needed. I mean, I remember years ago, Lauren Mosher, who was the head of, you know, schizophrenia studies at the NIMH and all that, and Soterios, we did a workshop together. And, you know, we just said, you know, the necessary and sufficient conditions for people who are in these extreme states to have to be helped is this kind of human-hearted connecting relationships. You know, and I even remembered, you know, Freud himself said, you know, psychoanalysis is a cure through love. But all that has been replaced. So when I see people, you know, in these extreme states, and I started, you know, back in the late 70s, I never see them through that paradigm of the disease model. And so I'm open there, and in a way that I can't shield myself. I can't defend myself against what the person, the pain and the terror and the rage and all that, I'm right there with it. And this is kind of funny, Peter, but a couple of weeks ago, a friend of ours, Yana Jacobs, you know, from the Foundation Excellent Mental Health Care, Yana and I were doing a workshop on this, being with people. And for some reason, I thought, hey, I'm going to see if I can figure out how many hours I've actually spent, you know, approximately, you know, being with people in these extreme states, because that's what I've specialized in all these decades. And it looks like it's probably around 21,000 or 22,000 hours one-on-one with people, sitting with them. A lot of it when they weren't on medication, because I was in those medication-free sanctuaries. So I just realized, like, wow, that's a lot of hours to be with someone and with the full intention of having my heart open versus seeing them as a diseased person.
Yeah. Hey, folks, we're open lines. I just realized, if you just tuned in recently, you don't know, we take calls now. This is a whole new format. Very exciting stuff I described in the beginning. But right now, and you can get the beginning next week if you missed it, because I'm going to replay the show. I'm away, and it talks about a whole new format and new stuff on the website that goes along with the radio show and so on. But it's 888-874-4888. And I know that most of you are calling just totally unprepared to do call-ins. I mean, most of you who are listening, because we've never done them. 7 years, I think, I haven't done a call. But give us a call. let us know what you think of the new format. Are you happy that you can call in? Are you happy you can email me now at the Bregan Live, Bregan Live at Hotmail.com, especially for the radio show, Bregan Live at Hotmail.com. Let me know how you feel about it and give a call. Really like to have you participating. 888-874-4888. Michael, you know, this stuff, the psychiatry is so far, far removed now from what people really need. It's like human needs are going in one direction, which is we need more connectivity and caring. We're being dispersed by and separated to some extent by social media. In some ways, it can be helpful and connect. You know, the whole society, our schools are bigger and bigger. It's harder to connect than them. Families break up so often that the parents are not even normally together anymore. It's just a tough situation out there for folks. And I'm not sure where the solutions go. They have to do with politics. They have to do with economics. But I don't know that we're addressing them at all. And politicians have never addressed this issue. You know, I guess it would get them right into the most important question, which is family life in America. Because that's, you know, I do family therapy whenever I can, because if I can heal a family, I've done my job. The family will take care of everything. And that doesn't matter whether you're 2 years old or whether you're 92 years old. You know, we heal if we can help family. Do you do much family work? I can't remember how much you do.
Yes, I do a lot of that. And that first program that I started in here in the Bay Area was called iWard, where it was one of those amazing places that were open. It was funded by federal dollars, state dollars. You know, it was a 20-bed sanctuary where we had this view of these extreme states are these emotionally overwhelming experiences that are natural. They make sense. It would be happening given what's come before in a person's life. So we did a lot of family therapy. And, you know, to this day, I always try and involve the family and friends, much like the very successful open dialogue, you know, that we hear about from Europe that is, you know, has an amazing success rate in helping people who, you know, have these extreme states. So, yeah, but there again, it's relationship, isn't it? You know, none of us are meant to.
And Michael, we have a caller that's right on that target, Andrea from California. Can we patch in Andrea?
Hello.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
You're the first caller on my new format. I haven't taken a caller on this show for 7 of the last 8 years. I take plenty of callers when I do other shows, other people's, but welcome aboard.
Thank you. I really appreciate this. I'll get right to my question. I'd like to know if you have any suggestions on how you deal with someone who you have a relationship with that is in an extreme state, and meaning a paranoid psychotic state.
Tell me some more about the situation, and we'll bring Michael in. He'll be talking too. Tell us a little bit more about it, if you can.
Okay. Well, at the age of 27, they had what appeared to be a breakdown, and actually, they were harmed because they were running through a forest, thinking that the CIA was after them. And they were in the hospital and ICU for a while. It took them about 2 years to recover from that episode. They did have them on antipsychotics for a while, but then the person discontinued them. And then they straightened out, and things went very well. And then it happened again for a brief period. And now they're just on clalazepam, which they would like to get off of. They're highly, highly productive. But when that state arises, I'm just not sure the best avenue, because I think you're right, the whole system is broken. I know in our area it takes 2 years to get in to see a psychiatrist.
Andrea, that's a blessing. Do you know how long it takes to get in to see a therapist, though? Like, you've got marriage and family therapists galore in California. And even if the person only wants to go in individually, they probably can get an appointment with a marriage and family counselor, maybe a clinical social worker. Does this person have a significant other?
No.
Well, they still could go to a marriage and family counselor or to somebody else. But let me bring in Michael, who probably, I'm sure, has actually more experience than I do dealing with people in psychotic states. And I've probably got a lot of experience. Michael,
yes.
Join in.
Well, Andrea, that's a situation that I'm real familiar with. I hear from people a lot about how to both respond and help find help for someone who's going through that. Part of what Peter and I are talking today is about the breakdown of the system and how some of these huge unmet needs aren't being met. But I think Peter's right on about if this person can find someone that they can connect with, that they feel has that empathic, compassionate response to them. To me, that's the key. And sometimes that's hard to find. You know, it may take searching through different resources. You know, there may be peer resources where they live, people who have been through these experiences, peer counseling. There may be some marriage family therapists. There may be
Michael. How does Andrea or her friend find a peer counselor in California? You've worked in that arena, I think, haven't you?
Yes, and it depends on where the person lives. In Northern California, here
Northern California.
In the Bay Area, there's quite a bit of peer resources. If this person or you want to contact me through my website, michaelcornwall.com, I'd be glad to try and connect you with referrals for some of those peer services. Also, let me just say, in my experience, it takes a very slow kind of withdrawal or tapering if the person's been on these drugs, if they're attempting to do that. That's always something that is challenging. We know from the research recently that the huge study that people who are put on these antipsychotic medications at 18 months, 80% of them aren't taking the medication. So that's a challenge if the person wants to get off the medication. In my experience, it really helps to have that person, like Peter and I are talking about, that compassionate, empathic person there. Just kind of tapering off the meds without that support, I think the odds are against the person. But if I'd be glad to provide some resources, referrals, if you will contact me.
Wonderful. I so appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Andrea, thank you for being the first caller to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour in 7 years or so with our new format. And feel free to call back in again. People like familiar people, and thank you for getting us off to a really, really good start with a really, really good question. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being there. Thank you.
All right. And we have another caller from California, Michael. You're going to get a lot of communications. This is Sarah about correctly diagnosing people. Sarah, hello.
Hello, Dr. Bregan.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for being the second caller in all these years.
I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to talk with you, and I apologize for my voice. I am a survivor, and I live with, I was misdiagnosed with toxic schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type with catatonia, and medicated on 5 classes of meds, 37 different combinations of 5 classes of meds for what they determined was treatment-resistant illness. But I just found your book, The Medication Madness, and it was such a relief to read that because it identified why I spiraled into such insanity and why I now live with neuroleptic-induced tardive dyskinesia and tardive dystonia and neuroleptic-induced Parkinsonianism because of a misdiagnosis. In January of last year, I finally found a different doctor who correctly diagnosed me with toxic encephalopathy, and I have not had psychiatric symptoms since. But because I've been dealing with my illness using diet and antifungal protocol. But if I would have learned the symptoms of spellbinding and had a doctor who was willing to spend time with me and listen instead of just snap diagnosed, I would not be in this problem that I am today.
Listen, first I want to tell you that you communicate very, very well, even though you may have some difficulty from a little change in your voice from the tardive dyskinesia. But folks, I'm just going to say quickly, and then I want Michael to come in, Michael Cornwall, my friend, my guest. Tardive dyskinesia afflicts, and you're not going to believe this initially, it afflicts most people on antipsychotic drugs, if they've been on them for a few decades. The odds go up and up, and by the time you've been on them a lifetime, which they want you to be on them often, you approach 100%. And how is that? Because the normal rate for a healthy person on these drugs is 5 to 8% a year, cumulative, yeah, over the years.
And it is
so imagine these rates. And if you let me just finish this, Sarah. And if you're an older person, if you're 55, which is way younger than me, and older, you have a risk rate that gets up to 20% or more a year. People who are having voice problems, movement problems, can't sit still, have agonizing feelings in their nervous system, grimacing, trouble swallowing, any kind of movement. Go ahead, Andrew. I'm sorry, Sarah. What were you saying? Some more.
There's a cumulative effect. It is, and like I taught at the university here at San Diego State University for 4 years in the psychiatric rehabilitation clinical track for the rehab counseling program. And recently I had to stop doing that just because it has like an acquired acetylcholine problem where my muscles just give out and I just have difficulty walking. I can be totally fine when I wake up in the morning, but by the time I've gotten ready, I no longer have the stamina to continue walking or talking. So it's just...
That is, Sarah, exhaustion in part. Exhaustion from the tardive dyskinesia is a very exhausting disorder. Take really good health care. Get on a plant-based diet. A plant-based diet with very little meat and no dairy. Plant-based whole food diet, and it might help. Michael, why don't you share with Sarah some of your thoughts, and then I want to go to Sally in North Carolina.
I just say, Sarah, I'm so sorry that happened to you, that you were so ill-served by psychiatry and misdiagnosed. And I'm just, I guess I could say I'm glad that you finally found what was true and that you're feeling better. But I'm really sorry. I mean, I just feel like it's so wrong that that was done to you. And you're in my prayers and thoughts. I hope it gets better.
It is getting better. I really appreciate your kind words. I found a doctor who is using a combination of NAD and amino acids to, and we're doing infusion therapies with targeted amino low doses of targeted amino acids with NAD. And good thing is the akathisia. I had protracted withdrawals. I've been off medication for, it'll be 3 years next month. But the protracted withdrawals were just severe. But now I no longer have REM sleep disorder. I no longer have akathisia. I no longer have sensory processing disorder. Now we're just trying to work on figuring out how to resolve this last neuromuscular issue. I'm grateful for those changes.
Well, bless you, Sarah. And I'm so glad, Michael, that you said what you said, because you know, when I meet people personally with TD, I always, it's the first thing I say very quickly after knowing them. First, I apologize for my colleagues and just, you know, tell you I understand what you're struggling with, because I see this a lot in my work and my legal work. I represent, as the, not represent, but as the expert, I'm their expert in legal cases. So, and God bless you. And Sarah, call in again. Let us know how you continue to do. And now I'm going
Thank
to go
both.
To Sally in North Carolina.
Hi, and, Dr. Bregan.
Hi, Sally. You'll be our last caller here.
Oh, well, good. I'm so glad. I'm finally getting to talk to you. I've been following you off and on ever since my son had his first episode back in when he was 19. He's now 27. And he's been on multiple medications and still is, and he self-medicates with alcohol and weed and things. And I just wanted to know, how realistic is it to taper off his medications without inducing a manic attack? And I think his ultimate diagnosis is schizoaffective disorder, whatever that is. I mean, I know what it is, but...
Well... It's going to be very hard for Michael or I to address anything that is quite so medical and that is without even having much detail. And we don't even have a lot of time for that. So let me just start by saying I've written a whole book about this, you know, and it's called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal.
Yes,
it's
and
a medical
I actually
book.
I have read that.
Oh, good, good, good. It's all about the situation, but I'll give you one or two hints from me, and then let's see what Michael says. And it depends on the will of the individual, and it depends on the support system. People to come off drugs after they've been on them for a long time, they really need a support system. And I think, again, a good therapist who can help build a support system of family is critical. The second thing is, I never encourage people to come off drugs any faster than they can bear. So most of my folks end up going slower than they want because I keep saying, well, you know, are you really ready? How do you feel? And they say, well, I just want to bull through it. I say, no. Mm-hmm. Let's take our time. So the only way to know about coming off the drugs ultimately is the experience that the person will have going slow. But the other part of it is the network is some sort of support system with professional help, if at all possible. Get professional help.
He has
a good therapist.
He does have that.
All right. Well, let me hand you to Michael. I'm not exactly handing him. He's in California.
Okay. Thank you. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Sally. Thank you for calling. And I agree with everything Peter says, and I'm glad you read his book. He is the expert on this. There's no one better or, you know, has better information. I just say, again, from my perspective as a therapist, I don't know if your son has that go-to person, that one person. But in my experience, again, if the disease model of psychiatry isn't accurate and there are other factors that cause us to go into these extreme states, which I believe are the emotional life that gets overwhelming, in my experience, when people try and taper off medication, even as slowly as Peter says, it can be really crucial for some people to have a therapist and that support system that Peter says, but especially maybe a therapist or a peer support person to help them try to understand the emotional overwhelm that happened before they went into extreme state. Because to me, those emotions are always waiting there. The medications numb them, like we say.
And yes, so he to is how, very numbed.
To mm-hmm. be able to, huh?
What's that? He is very numb from all the medications.
So as soon as those medications are lifted, even slowly, if those emotions aren't integrated and understood and even expressed and honored and known, that's, in my view, just as in my opinion, that's what can, even a person does a slow taper, they can go back into an extreme state if some of that emotional work isn't done.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And Michael, you, I don't think you got to mention that you have the new volume out on extreme states and with your beautiful article in it, mine. Have we mentioned that and how people might get a hold of it?
Well, maybe I'll quickly say, Peter, yeah, there's a special edition of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology that I was asked to edit on extreme states.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, we've only got a minute left. And so let me say, maybe you can get that from your library. Maybe you can order it online. Find different ways. Maybe your university or your school can get it for you. And it's a very, very, very good compendium. Yeah.
Yeah, Peter. Oh, Sally, for you, if you go to my website, michaelcornwall.com, there are links to that journal that has Peter's article and mine, and it's kind of the latest thing, 20 authors writing on.
Give your website real quick, and then we're signing off.
Yeah, michaelcornwall.com.
michaelcornwall.com, and I am peterbregan.com. Bregan. Listen, folks, new format. We have call-ins from now on, 888-874-4888. You can email me and tell me how you like the new show. Give me suggestions. Tell me who you want to hear on. BreganLive@Hotmail.com. BreganLive@Hotmail.com. You can find follow-ups on these articles by going to Bregan.com and look for breaking news and information. And you can get links to the articles. It's been a great joy for me to get the courage to just transform this format, listen in, tell your friends about it, let folks know that they really can talk with me and communicate with me now through emails, and it'll influence the show, and we're going to have wonderful people on to help me answer your questions. This is new, folks. And again, thank you for being such a great audience all these years, supporting what I do, letting me know indirectly, because you didn't have a direct method before, for doing it. This is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, and I'm just delighted to be here with you. Thank you, Michael Cornwall.
Thank you.